A little bouncer slowly toward Bryant. He will glove it and throw to Rizzo. It's in time! And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series!
I remember running home from school, turning on the TV to the Cubs game, sitting with my dad to watch his heroes.
Welcome to the World Series Dreaming Chicago Cubs Dreamcast, now hanging out with Obstructed View. We are not affiliated with the actual Chicago Cubs, we're just a bunch of fans who love the local nine and attacking baseball, including the 2016 World Series champion Cubs. Hello, this is Kevin. With me is Adam from Obstructive View and whoever else decides to join us tonight, including that guy that just popped in. Hi, Skip. You just came in right after the intro. But welcome, gentlemen. How's your weekend been?
Fantastic.
Awesome, awesome.
Well, I've been doing my taxes, so I could have had a better weekend than that.
All right, the 15th is coming up. But hopefully you do not owe. Owing sucks.
I think I'm going to be pretty close to right at even, which would be pretty great.
Yeah, because that's how you're supposed to rig it, right? Like, you're supposed to make sure that the government doesn't take or you have to give them more. So if you have it at almost exactly zero, that's the sweet money spot so that they don't get your interest-free loan.
That's right.
So that's good.
Did you happen to see on the updated tax code if you have to do anything special if, like, $600 million of your salary is deferred until 10 years from now?
That sounds like a California problem.
Okay. Asking for a friend. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, the feds are going to get theirs, but I don't know about California. There's only so much you can claim duty free. That's all I'm saying. We are at the Sunday right before the very long West Coast trip. And if I had told you at the beginning of the year that the Cubs would be winning 6 out of the first 9 games, would you have believed me?
I would. I feel like you're a pretty honest guy. Okay. And it's a small enough sample that I would have believed it, but I probably would have guessed that the 3 losses would have come at the hands of the Dodgers.
That's probably fair. We can talk about that too. And, you know, the Cubs have been affected by the swath of pitching injuries that has hit MLB, and that's caused a little bit of hubbub across the MLB and MLB Players Union. We can have some thoughts about, you know, third base and basically Christopher Morel's defense, and also perhaps Michael Busch, because Adam has thoughts. And then we can talk about, you know, the council effect through these first 9 games. Essentially, 153 games left, but, you know, the math says that the Cubs are going to go 6-3 throughout the next however many it is. I can't do math right now, but there are a lot of 9-game series coming up, and so we can, or 9-game sets coming up, and we can kind of look at it piece by piece and just kind of get annoyed at the majors because in early scoreboard watching, it's not been as favorable to the Cubs as we would like, but 6-3 is a good start. So how's that for a plan, guys?
I love this plan. I'm excited to be a part of it. Let's do it.
Sounds great.
As the spring gave away to summer, past the ivy-colored dreams, toward the days that kept us yearning for tomorrow.
Based on stuff that I've been reading, it sounds like if you looked at the top 10 of pitchers in terms of either WAR or ERA, 8 out of 10 of them are now on the shelf. And these are like serious injuries, like their shoulders and elbows types of injuries. And I think Justin Steele has his hamstring injury and Killian has his shoulder injury and Taillon is coming back from his back issue. So those aren't, except for Killian's, not as serious, but you're just seeing like every other day someone has to have a Tommy John surgery or someone has to have an IL stint because their elbow's sore. And Gerrit Cole may or may not be playing catch again on Monday. Things like that. So My feeling is this is a velocity issue. This is not a pitch clock issue. This is like everybody's throwing out of their minds. They're going max effort every time. They don't care that there's a pitch clock now. They're just still going to throw 100% each time. They don't know how to throttle back. And I think that's what's causing the uprise in injuries. And I feel like the very famous surgeons, including James Andrews, kind of agree with that. Like, there's so much torque, there's so much velocity. The human arm was not evolved to do this. So I just wanted to throw that out there and just kind of help thank my lucky stars that the Cubs aren't as affected just yet.
Yeah, it's hard to comment on it. Typically, when we analyze something this important, we're going to hard statistics. And it's difficult to get serious statistics and data together that seems reliable, like, okay, this is what's happening. And especially when you allow for the variance that you would expect in any stat, it feels like the type of thing that we're very likely to be guessing at. Pitch clock being a factor doesn't really even pass the smell test for me. Like, when you're talking about like tissue damage, are we really thinking that there's like serious repair and restoration being done in those extra seconds in between pitches? Like, I don't think that's real. Like, that's the kind of thing that I would expect to cause an injury when the arm doesn't have an opportunity to heal itself in between strenuous activity. And I don't think the pitch clock is a factor. I would say if you go to 3 days rest from 4 days rest or from 5 days rest, that would be a factor for me. But changing the number of seconds in between pitches, that I would expect that to affect velocity, but not injury. So I don't know. It seems to me like the kind of thing where you could find data where you want it to kind of help you out, but it would be quite a feat to make that a really convincing argument.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you went back and you looked sort of historically at fast-working pitchers versus slow-working pitchers, then you could say, well, the slow-working pitcher should have fewer arm injuries. But I don't think you're going to find that. I don't think that data exists. I think that the Players Union this year, you know, they've been talking about the pitch clock, and they've been citing it with these injuries. But I agree with you, Adam, and Ken. I think it's baloney because we're only talking about 2 seconds when there's guys on base as far as the change between this year and last year, if I remember correctly. And so that's really not that many of the pitches that are being thrown. And who knows, for the guys that are already injured, it may have only been 5 or 6 pitches, and if your elbow's going to give out because of that, there's already a problem. So I really think, you know, you're looking at, you know, all this emphasis on velocity and spin and all these pitch labs and all that kind of stuff, and it really kind of makes me wonder if in the process of refining every pitcher's approach to maximize spin, they're also ignoring some of the biomechanical limitations that are there in the elbow and the shoulder.
Yeah, I definitely hear that. I know that when I was coaching high school baseball, like by the time I started, they had implemented pitch limits. And I think this was like actually a mandate from MLB on down. I don't know if they followed it as stringently in NCAA, but in high school, like, kids can't throw more than 105 pitches per game. And then there's like a strict number from then on, depending on how much rest they have. Like, if they throw the max 105 pitches, they can't pitch the next day. If they throw 75, they can pitch like a certain number of pitches the next day, and so on. And then there was some reading that I did a long time ago about how it was important not to teach a kid a curveball or a slider until he was of a certain age or a developmental stage. And that makes sense because the arm is still growing. The muscles are still knitting themselves together. You're getting stronger. Like, you know, kids are working out. Some of them look like bodybuilders, you know. But It does make sense to make sure that they're properly developed, that they have the bones and the ligaments and everything in place before they do that. But considering how many high schoolers get drafted in the first round and the fact that these front offices are looking for velocity and movement and all that, like, where's the incentive not to have them hurt themselves? And I think that's a major problem. And I think James Andrews actually said something to that effect.
Yeah, and I think in this, along the same lines, some of the Dan Heron who said something about, you know, using weighted balls and all the methods that they do training to just increase velocity in general. But, you know, at the same time, it just, you know, I just feel like we're guessing, you know, like the answer could just as well be in the way that you handle pitchers when they're recovering from a performance. Like, more research needs to be done into what's the right way to care for your throwing mechanism. You know, all the various muscle and tendon groups that go into throwing, what's the proper way to care for those during recovery? I don't know, because I haven't researched them.
Yeah, I feel like the new market inefficiency might be something like what the Cubs are showing, where they only have the two major pitchers on the IL right now. Everybody else seems to be fine, knock on wood. We'll see if that stays the case, like, later on. But, you know, so far, it's a hammy and a back. It's not their arms. So, yay us, I guess. But the market inefficiency might be, can we keep our pitchers healthy for the longest period of time so that they can be useful when we need them most, you know? And perhaps the Cubs have figured something out. I don't know. But I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch, as the parlance goes. I'd like to hope that the medical staff on the Cubs has figured out something. Or maybe the pitchers themselves have, like, a really good training regimen and recovery strategy, like you said. But, there's a lot of variables. I think the chief variable, though, is, like, when we were growing up and we were watching baseball in, like, probably the late 80s, early 90s, you can probably count on your two hands all those who could throw 100 miles an hour. And now you need many more hands to do that. So that's the main variable that I see, is first the velocity, and then the fact that these pitches are going all over the place with velocity. And that's just a lot of pressure on one joint.
Yeah, and I think there's just a philosophical question that a lot of athletes face today is, how bad does the risk have to be versus the reward of getting to compete and thrive on the professional level? How big does the risk have to be for it not to be worth it? And a lot of athletes, pretty much the entire NFL, a lot of pitchers are like, yeah, I'll risk it for a chance to be in the show and to throw 102 miles an hour and all of that. So that's kind of where you at least hope that the competitors, the athletes themselves, have as much information as they can possibly have about what the risks are of, you know, taking their bodies to these extreme performance levels. But you don't really know that too many of them would be like, oh, well, then if my risk is a 30% chance that I'm going to be out for the year, I'm not going to do it. Like, they're young guys. They're used to being able to do what, you know, whatever they attempt to do. And I think a great percentage of them would just say, hey, you know, I'll take the risk. Let's do it.
Well, I think you're kind of already seeing that both on the amateur level and also with, you know, with Major League Baseball as they draft, right? Because you've got a lot of guys now in high school or in college that are already getting Tommy John surgery, and they're like, well, I might as well get it out of the way now because I'm going to come back and have, you know, 3-4 miles an hour added to my fastball. And then you see, like, the Cubs, you know, they was it Moulet that they drafted last year that was just coming off of Tommy John, and maybe there were two guys that they drafted that really didn't pitch last year because they were recovering from Tommy John. So the teams don't feel like it's a risk, you know, if you've had it before you're at the major league level, right? Because they're like, fine, you know, this guy's already got it out of the way. Let's go. Let's draft him. He should be good.
I think you might be thinking of Cade Horton, who I think they drafted as sort of like a later round pick, or maybe it was a first round and they underslotted, but he was picked and they were able to get him because he was coming off Tommy John as he was finishing up college. That's the only one I can think of. There is so much incentive. Like maybe it's a timing thing where they say, okay, well, you like what I can do. I'm going to show you everything that I can do, and then I'm going to trick you, and in this case, you being the New York Yankees, into giving me $300 million, and now I can't play catch for like X number of months, you know? So maybe the risk is worth the reward after all, right? Or is it vice versa? The reward is worth the risk. Which way is it, guys?
Both.
Okay, cool. Yeah, but you know what I'm saying? Like, if you time it well enough, some guys don't even do the Tommy John. Like when Masahiro Tanaka hurt himself, they just like injected his elbow with platelet-rich plasma or something, and then he just decided not to throw his fastball as much anymore, and he was fine. So maybe they get lucky that way, but they've got their money. Now it's a team's problem, and the team has to figure out where they're going to get those innings back from, you know? So luckily for the Cubs, I guess they have plenty of depth, so we can actually kind of move on to talking about how they've been trying to replace Steele and Jameson Taillon lately. I think the big one is actually Ben Brown. When Steele was still in the rotation, it was like Wicks and Assad. And now Assad has to move into the rotation even more because Taillon's missing, and so is Steele. And to kind of replace what Steele has, they've been trying like piggybacks with, I guess, Drew Smyly and Ben Brown. And Brown did get shelled in Texas, but I guess that was kind of expected. But he looked really good against the Rockies. So, you know, that was nice. I think what I'd like to see is how they do when they're not in stupid Texas and in stupid Chicago weather. Because right now it's just kind of like really weird mitigating circumstances to start the season for our pitching.
I was going to say, it seems like the Chicago weather kind of helped out with this Dodgers series, so I'm all for that. But, man, watching Ben Brown pitch when they were talking about changing the game time because of snow in his, you know, short-sleeve jersey with no undershirt or anything. I mean, you could tell this kid's from New York, right? Because apparently that cold didn't faze him at all. And I was sitting here in South Carolina just shivering watching him. But he looked pretty darn good in that second outing that he had.
Yeah, he kind of reminded me of an eighth grader who's just like, yeah, cold is a mindset. Don't worry about it. I want to wear shorts on the mound. Like, yeah, it was pretty cool to see to see him throw with that same reckless abandon. But yeah, I mean, can't really complain about the starting pitching so far. Shota, 10 innings, no runs, no walks. I'll take it. Assad just continues to be like the, oh, yeah, I can be an ace if you need me to. Otherwise, I can be kind of a mid-spot reliever or whatever. It's very cool to see that. Hendricks, I kind of expect to always be like the Ryan Sandberg of pitchers, and just in April, it's going to take a while for him to get it together and get into midseason form. Jordan Wicks, not too shabby. Didn't break against the Dodgers. Wicks, he's had to have, like, his two starts have been Dodgers Rangers. Is that right?
That is correct. So has Hendricks, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's that's a rough 1-2 punch, especially when they're both kind of finesse guys. Like, you do not have any wiggle room. So, I mean, I guess it's kind of good that they just kind of jump straight into the fire to start the season. But so far, you haven't faced an average circumstance yet. Like, two of the best offenses you're going to see, and then the Rockies. And yeah, weather just crazy. So that's, but you know, at the same time, this early in the season, it's not even a representative sample anyway. So it's all good. But the bare basics of what we're seeing, it looks good. Shota especially, just, man, swing and miss stuff. He's basically tracing the outline of the strike zone for the most part. Occasionally he'll just challenge with the fastball that gets a big chunk of the plate. But yeah, he looks fantastic.
Yeah, it's safe to say he's exceeding expectations. And also, he's a short sleeve guy. So that's two straight starts where he's just been, you know, it's not the perfect weather. Maybe it was nicer today. I can't really tell because I don't have my weather bug on for Chicago, yeah, but yeah. I feel like it's been two cold days, two cold starts for him, and he's just been like, short sleeves, whatever. So good for him. And I feel like if they're washed away, you know, most of his start, he would have gone like 6 or 7 because his pitch count was so manageable. But then again, he was like on the way to facing them a third time, so you never know. Like, you can't really keep this Dodgers team down for too long, but somehow the Cubs did. They won 2 out of 3, and that was extremely unexpected, I would say. Maybe I wouldn't say I was surprised, but I would have to say I didn't expect it, if that makes sense. Because with the council effect, anything can happen. But one thing that I'm kind of bummed about is the fact that only Shota once and Assad have gone to 6 innings. In fact, I think they're the only ones so far to have gone more than 5 innings. Like, Wicks the other day only went 4.2, so 4 4 2/3, so he didn't get to 5. And there's been a lot of like 4 innings or barely 4-inning starts, just a lot of bullpen having been used up early. So I think Council kind of knows how to manage through that, but at the same time, there's only so much the arms can take before they get tired, and it's kind of thankful for these early off days.
Yeah, and we still don't really know how the bullpen is going to shape up. I mean, Merriweather on the 15-day IL, that hurts. Luke Little has looked good. We just haven't seen a ton of him. But yeah, everybody else just kind of looked like somewhat shaky. Even Adbert, not dominant, I would say. You know, he's getting men on base. He's mostly getting out of it. Some of it feels a little lucky, but he also just hasn't gotten a ton of opportunities so far, just 4 appearances. Yeah, you hope they don't get overworked, but at the same time, it's still early, and we've already had to do 1 bullpen day as the starting, you know, or the opener, when it was Little who opened after pitching in the game before, and then when Ben Brown got his biggest outing out of the way. And it's kind of nice when they have the alliterative tandem of Luke Little and Ben Brown going 1-2 to start the game. I wouldn't mind if they did that one more time. Again, big fan of alliteration. Even if you can't get hitters out, at least it sounds good coming off the tongue.
Plus, we get the unusual thing about Luke Little being the first Cub since 1955 to close out one game and then start the next one, which is, you know, one of those odd baseball things that my wife is always shaking her head when I talk about. But, you know, that's kind of fun, too. I really figured they'd probably send him down after that and bring up a fresh arm for the pen. But I guess, you know, with the off days and some of the relievers gone having a little bit longer outings when they have come in, then maybe they feel like they're okay, especially now that they've got Palencia up instead of Merriweather. So the, you know, the shuttle back and forth has already started.
I think there's a chance that Palencia, after eating those three innings to really save the rest of the bullpen, he's the one that gets sent down, and that he won't be back until like 15 days are up or someone else breaks, hopefully not. But that leaves two possibilities that you can call up without having to make a roster move. One is Keegan Thompson, and the other is Hayden Wesneski. So that Merriweather injury does kind of, like you said, it starts the roulette going. But, I don't think he's going to be able to pitch for a few days. But I don't know whether they're willing to just, like, kind of wash out those next 15 days or just stick with him until the next time he pitches and then call up someone else. I really don't know. It's Jed's league, right?
Yeah, I'm an ignorance is bliss person in this regard. Like, I don't care. Do what you do, Jed. Make it happen. I'm sure it'll be fine.
I think the fact that they didn't have to pitch Brown or Smiley today makes it so that they're available for, you know, long relief or another start against San Diego. I don't really know how Petco plays anymore. I know they've moved the fences in and they've like switched some dimensions around, but I don't actually know if it's easier or harder to hit there anymore. I just know it's huge, like most of the NL West parks. They're just huge, expansive outfields. So it might be a little more difficult to find grass, but maybe they'll do some really cool stuff because the offense, you know, that there was like these two vaunted high-velocity arms from the Dodgers, and the Cubs just kind of ground them down. It was great. Like, every single at-bat was like 6, 7, 8 pitches, and they walk a lot. They probably are still, like, leading the league in on-base percentage and walks and stuff. So, like, for whatever reason, maybe even more than we had hoped, this offense is clicking, and it's really cool to see.
Yeah, so far they're really pesky. Like I haven't seen updated data after today's games, but the last I had checked, the Cubs were leading the majors in walk rate and in lowest strikeout rate, which is a fantastic combination. Again, small sample, be damned. That's good to see so far. Definitely not what I was predicting, especially in regard to the strikeout rate. I've been very happy with Morel. Not that he's not striking out at all, but he's shown pretty decent plate discipline so far. Overall, the whole team is, they're looking maybe like how I said, the whole team is kind of very Ian Happ-esque. They're kind of getting a little Mike Tauchman-esque as well. Just long at bats, a lot of line drives, not a ton of grounding into double plays. Knock on wood for all this stuff. But as I'm watching the team from the perspective of an opponent, I'm thinking this is a really annoying team to face. It's very a similar vibe to the Diamondbacks when the Cubs were playing them at the end of last year. But it's just like, there's just not a lot of easy outs. And there's a lot of people who, the way that they're swinging the bat, really don't want them up there anymore. Like, Morel hasn't exactly taken off, but at the same time, I would not want to pitch to him right now. He's swinging so confidently and so ferociously. It's like, I have to imagine the pitcher is thinking, like, just be done. Someone else, please come up to the plate, because I don't want to see that lightsaber bat cutting through the air of the strike zone. Yeah, a lot of good things. I've been, you know, one defensive blip aside that we can touch on later, but Bush has looked really solid. Not a terror, but definitely not an easy out. A dangerous bat, to be sure. Even like Horner and Swanson, I felt like neither of those guys seemed like walk guys to me, but they're both taking more walks than I remember them ever taking. So yeah, that just a lot of good things. And Seiya, yeah, very, very happy with the torrent of hard hit balls that he is introduced the season with. So definitely, like, thinking back to last year at this time, it's like night and day in terms of how the lineup is looking on a day in, day out basis.
Wanted to very quickly let you guys know that as of yesterday, I don't think they updated it yet on Fangraphs, but the Cubs are now projected by Fangraphs to win the NL Central. They're a game ahead of the Cardinals, despite being like half a game and a game, respectively, behind the Brewers and the Pirates, who are just kind of lucky horseshoe with their schedule so far. Like, the rest of the NL Central has seemed to be just beating up on cupcakes and, you know, getting lucky against would-be contenders like, you know, the Mariners or in the case of the Pirates, the Orioles. But it's really cool to see that the Cubs made it through one of the toughest parts of their schedule, and they're only like a game behind first place, which may or may not be a mirage. We don't know if the Pirates will fade like they did last year. They're supposedly a better team, but it'd be kind of nice to see the Cubs make it through the end. I think you had alluded to the defense, and one thing that I want to say before that, so the DH has mostly been like a rotation between all the outfielders, which is kind of cool, and it's gotten Talkman into the fold where he's walking basically half the time he's up to bat. Like, you know, he's striking out and maybe getting a clutch hit the other half of the time, but he's walking like a ton. I think he leads the league in but he definitely leads the team in walks, despite not having like even half the at bats that Ian Happ is at. So that's a really, really funny small sample stat. But it's kind of nice because I think aside from Talkman, there's not a quote official outfielder, like a fifth outfielder. So you definitely do not want Garrett Cooper out in the outfield. You probably don't want Mastroboni in the outfield, and the rest are infielders. So it's basically the three regulars and Talkman, and the fact that he's rotating them around the DH spot is really cool. I think it's basically helping keep them fresh. And at some point they might do the same with the infielders, because at some point Nico and Dansby are going to need a day off, but that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. And how much fun was it seeing the reigning two-time Gold Glove left fielder have a defensive replacement that is an upgrade in Talkman, Bellinger, Suzuki? That's an outfield, man. There was not really a gap to be had in the outfield today, and that was pretty fun to watch. Definitely a fun defensive day today. Even though, yeah, there have been ups and downs for the defense, which overall I think is fine. Extremely mitigating circumstances so far in the year as far as the conditions that they're playing in. But today's game was one where, yeah, the pitching, without question, was very, very good today. But the defense was outstanding as well. And it just seemed so suffocating. Like, sorry, like you're going to have to be Ohtani if you want to find a hole. It just was not a very easy day to hit against the Cubs. That was pretty fun to see, especially against a team who I don't think did particularly poorly, but when they did hit the ball hard, the Cubs were just on it. So that was pretty fun.
Well, it feels to me like, you know, there's one hole right now in the defense, and of course we all know where that is, but that's not for lack of potential, I would say, still with Morel. And for a change, it feels like the Cubs are doing these things that successful teams do well consistently. And you guys have touched on that. They're pests at the plate, you know, where, you know, you're not just going to go up there for three pitches and watch a good pitch, you know, go by and then, you know, take 2 weeks swings. The days of the Cubs as strikeout leaders hopefully are behind us. You know, they'll battle through at bats. Really good defense, pretty much all around the diamond. That's pretty great. And, you know, enough depth and you know, on the mound to persevere. You know, I still don't feel like we have an amazing pitching staff, but I also don't think we have a terrible pitching staff. Last year, it felt like, you know, the first half of the season, we had a good starting staff and not much of a bullpen. And then the second half was sort of the opposite. And so, but it feels a little more balanced this year. And so, you know, those are teams that do well. So, you know, that end up in the playoffs. And I know it's only 9 games, but it's hard not to be excited by what we're seeing so far.
Adam, I know we wanted to talk about Morel and Bush, so I will lead off by just saying that for me, Morel has range. He has athleticism. He can get to the ball. Whether he can get a glove on the ball is a different story. But, you know, when it's to his right, I think sometimes a ball scoots under him, and maybe that's just N equals 2 or 3 for that one. But on pop-ups, on balls to his left, he can get there. So getting there is, I guess, the hardest part. And then for him, actually, the hardest part happens to be the throw. Can he get the throw to the first baseman? And then I think you're going to talk about this next, but Bush has a problem picking up bad throws, whether it's from Morel himself or from Miles Mastroboni. So that at the two corners, those are things to watch, but I think with more reps, they'll figure it out.
Yeah, I think that's true too. Morel, you know, he's not as sure-handed as you want, not as consistent with his throws, but I also feel like he doesn't seem to really let it bother him. If you've been through the Steve Sachs, Chuck Knobloch trials where suddenly it just, the yips for them were so bad, they'd stare down the first baseman and they just couldn't throw it. I mean, it wasn't even close. They just couldn't do it anymore. And it was like, if they had it happen once, the next time the ball was hit to them, it was like you could see the thought bubble of curse symbols over their head. Like, they just didn't want the ball. And Morel so far seems just like, okay, I messed up that one. Give me another one. I'll do it. See, no problem. He doesn't seem to really be in his head all that much, which is a good thing. Like, that to me is great. And you grow up watching Mark Grace at first base, you know, where he's just a Hoover vacuum cleaner and he's scooping up everything that hits dirt in front of him. And it's okay that Michael Bush is not that. Like, totally acceptable. It's kind of a luxury item to have a first baseman who can really scoop the throws in the dirt. Like, throw in the dirt, you scoop it up, amazing. Like, fantastic, A-plus effort, exceeds expectations, wonderful. The problem I have with Bush, and it's really the only problem I have with Michael Bush, is he has this hitch in his technique where when he goes to scoop a ball, he lets it get past his glove. He has his glove angled in such a way that as he's raising his glove in front of him, he hits the ball and deflects it up into the air. And 3 times so far this year, he has deflected it out of play. On balls that it's not Morel airmailing him and it just flying into the stands. It hits the ground. He slows it down, but he knocks it up and it's either sailing directly or bouncing high into the dugout or the camera well or whatever it is. And it's like, I would rather him just be like, oh, it's in the dirt, I'm not going to try to get it. And then it would be, okay, the error is that runner's on first. But in three instances, it's been the bad throw brought the guy to first. But his hitch in his scoop method has sent the runner to second. And that small correction, it's like a different angle, you know, holding your glove in a different way, using a different timing mechanism, whatever it is, like whatever little trick you play to try and scoop the ball on the short hop is fine, but you can't have your glove angled in such a way that it's a pinball flipper and knocking it, you know, high into the air and out of play. So that's my one little critique of his defense. I couldn't be the instructor to get him to be able to scoop the really difficult throws out of the dirt. I would love to see him get to that point, and I imagine that a realistic expectation for him to add that to his repertoire is probably another season, but just need to cut down on actually deflecting the ball and making a bad throw even worse.
Yeah, I guess as Cubs fans, even when the teams were bad, we were spoiled by first Mark Grayson, then Derek Lee, and then Anthony Rizzo at first base. Like, it was really, really good for such a long time. And
even Bellinger last
year. Yeah, for real. Yeah, I did. I guess I forgot about him. Now I feel bad. But yeah, that was really nice. So it's a relative downgrade, but I feel like if Prince Fielder can do it, and if Vogelbach, when they let him stand there, can sort of do it, and Pete Alonso can do it, why not Michael Bush?
I think both these guys, you know, let's give them a little more time. Some guys grow into their defense. Remember Soriano when he came over? He wasn't that great in the outfield. And then the Cubs actually had outfield defensive coaches. And he even said, you know, I've never been coached in the outfield before. And so we'll see what the coaches do with these guys. But it's also been wet. There's been, you know, a couple games that have been pretty wet. And I'm a little less concerned about all that for now. I'd like to give it another, I don't know, months and see where things go. I hadn't noticed that thing that you mentioned, though, on Michael Bush's techniques. I'll definitely watch for that. But what I love on Morrell is exactly what you mentioned, Adam, is that he doesn't seem to carry one play to the next play. And I think that's since we've been talking about high school baseball, that's a really good lesson where you could show your high school players, look at this guy, right? I mean, he made a terrible error there. He threw the ball to first base that no human ever on this earth could have caught. The next play, he's totally right into it. His next at bat, he doesn't carry it in, doesn't carry it along with him. He's got a great at bat. He hits a home run. That's the right approach, and that's what makes successful major leaguers. Whether he ends up being a third baseman long term, I guess we'll still have to wait and see. But gosh, I feel like his approach so far is one that it's given me some hope.
Yeah, I'm definitely feeling very positive about the direction the entire defense is headed. Morrell and Bush definitely have room to improve, and it's good that neither one of them is under the gun to have to develop at any specific rate. It is a long season, and there are enough tools on the team to be able to take that load off, you know, to give Morrell the occasional DH breather. And I like that he's not being transferred to different positions. Like, if you spend 3 days as a third baseman and 3 days as a DH, that is a heck of a lot easier than spending 3 days as a third baseman, 1 day as a second baseman, 1 day as the first baseman, and 1 day as the DH. It's just two completely different experiences for Morrell this year. So I'm definitely not feeling impatient with that. And even the thing with Bush, like, even if it never happens again, the main reason I think it's important to keep in mind is that I feel like the errors that Morrell has made have looked twice as bad because they've resulted in an extra base. But when you look at the throws themselves, like, they haven't been that bad. He's probably had one or two, like, oh, wow, that wasn't good throws. But for the most part, like, you throw a ball in the dirt to first base, that happens to everybody. It's just when the runner ends up at second base or it's in a key situation, like, that's it, it stings a little bit more. But I don't think those extra bases have been because the throws have been that wild. I think it's just been these fluke things that happen. And again, part of the reason they've happened and part of the reason that they've even been errors that weren't saved is you've got a guy learning on the fly first base for the most part. I mean, it's not that easy, and it's nice to know there's a really good chance that things could be much better at the end of the year, even if it's just this group, even if they don't make any key additions moving forward. Like, they have everything they need to improve by 5 or 10% defensively, and that's pretty encouraging.
Yeah, I really do like it, and I also like the timeshare that they have with Madrigal and Morrell at third base, sometimes Mastroboni. But basically, I think for most of the pitchers, they're just like, okay, Morrell, you take it. But then for contact managers like Jordan Wicks or Kyle Hendricks, you would actually see Madrigal at third base because you would expect more ground balls from them. So I think that's sort of what I'm seeing in the early going, and I'm okay with that. It makes sense because Madrigal is actually healthy. He seems to be hitting. He plays great defense, and it's shown, and hopefully that continues. I do want to note that actually the Cubs are now 1.5 games behind the Pirates because the Baltimore Orioles decided to suck this weekend. They're a half game behind the Brewers, but it's really interesting that the NL Central right now is the only division with all five teams at 500 or above. It's kind of interesting. And I guess that's just early season scheduling shenanigans for you.
Yeah, I felt like we were saying, oh, yeah, things sure didn't turn out the way we thought they would in this first week of the season last year. And then it was just like, oh, the Mets keep losing. The Mets are still terrible. The Orioles are actually pretty great. The entire AL East is really good. So it'll be interesting to see with the wild cards that are, well, I guess the whole NL Central is kind of a wild card to some degree. It should be fun. I don't even want to imagine, but can you imagine if this division turned into this year's AL East?
Well, that'd be a lot of fun, wouldn't it? I mean, I think it's pretty unlikely still, but it at least, you know, it'd be a lot of fun. It would inject a lot of energy into the last half of the year.
Yeah, for sure. And unfortunately, only 3 wild cards, so I guess the Cardinals can sit out another year. But yeah, it's really cool to see them having fun and making us feel excited early on in the year. 9 games, so there's not really much to tell. I think, you know, probably Dodgers fans are freaking out right now because, oh my God, they just lost a series to the Cubs, which is apparently our April World Series or something. But, you know, fans are going to fan, and I just want to see how the rest of this 162 games goes. I feel like they still probably are going to trade for a bat and another arm come July, but I'm not like panicking about it at all. Like, I really like the way this is looking for us.
Yeah. And again, obviously it's still really early, but just comparing it to last year at this time, if a year ago you had said, okay, the Cubs are going to add a couple of pieces, what should they add to the team to really make this team competitive? I kind of would have snort laughed and said, Can by a couple, do you mean six? Because it just felt like there were holes all over the place, you know, especially with some early season injuries and things like that. But with this team, it'd be like, I mean, if they added a serious bullpen weapon and a nice utility infielder bat or outfield DH option who can seriously put up 40 or 50 home runs, like, you know, that type of expiring contract guy, that would make this team look really scary at this point.
I think we needed another starting pitcher, maybe two, to make this team really scary.
I'm fine with the patchwork starting pitching. And obviously I'll take a starting pitcher, but like you could dramatically increase the bullpen and the lineup with just a couple of moves is the main point. And yeah, we just kind of have to see how Taillon and Steele emerge from their respective injuries to kind of see what this rotation truly looks like. But if I'm projecting to end of the year, having Shota and Steele and whoever the hot hand between Hendricks, Wicks, and Taillon, and then, you know, Cy Young, Assad, it's definitely a situation where with a couple of improvements, again, looking at it from the opponent, not a team I would want to face, especially in a short series.
Yeah, I've been quietly being very good at building depth in this team. Like, there's nobody that really screams out at you, but sometimes, I guess, as they say, you just need to build in the aggregate, and the aggregate looks really, really good right now. And there's, like, potential for superstardom in there somewhere. Just got to wait it out, guys.
And based on MLB's new policy, if you add a front of the rotation starter, he will be getting injured. So this is as good as we can expect.
And if Taillon and Steele come back, that's basically an upgrade from what we have now. So yay. And then there are the guys in the minors who are getting ready to break through. And I really hope for their success. We got 9 games coming up on the road, all on the West Coast. So I'm just picturing the Indiana Jones like travel dot in my mind. So there's a line going from Chicago to San Diego. So that's like 2,000 miles plus. And then they're going to go north to Seattle for 3. And then south back down to Phoenix for another 3 before they go back to Chicago for a homestand, which is a really, really stupid way to travel. But I guess they couldn't really get away from doing that. So, yeah, that's like 4,000 to 5,000 miles of travel right there.
I hate snakes, Jock. That's how I feel with the last 3 games of that trip.
Yeah. So all 3 of these guys are purportedly in playoff contention. So this is still a very rough part of the schedule. If they come out of this doing pretty well, then they have the Marlins, who just barely won their first game against the Cardinals. Hopefully that'll be a nice respite. They get another off day before they have to face the Astros, and then they're back on the road again to end the month. So it's a rough
April.
Yeah, they have to face the Astros, but the Astros have been kind of lately. But they're also the Astros, right? So it's not like they're going to stay down forever. So it's a lot of craziness. But, you know, once they're done, they'll just go to Boston, face the Red Sox, and then they'll face the Mets. And I don't know which version of Red Sox or Mets will show up. So, you know, that's why they play the game. So I think if they go through this West Coast road trip and go like 5-4 or 4-5, I think we're in pretty good shape. More wins is obviously better.
I think you'd always say that, you know, on these big West Coast road trips. The weird thing is, you know, despite the projections, San Diego, Arizona, and Seattle all are under 500 right now. Again, small sample size, it means as much as us being over, but it's not like any of those teams are really tearing the cover off the ball yet. So maybe they will still be trying to find their way, and we'll keep them you know, in the bushes for a while.
Yeah, and I just want to reflect back really quick on the series with the Dodgers. I had it in my head that because of how the offseason went and all their, you know, gaudy acquisitions, that I was just going to be like, oh, poo on the Dodgers. Who even wants to watch that? But watching the Dodgers play and watching so far every team I've watched play against the Dodgers, but, you know, having the opportunity to play against them is very exciting. That is extremely compelling baseball to see what it brings out of the opposition when you're up against essentially a quasi all-star team. That was intense for, you know, rainy days of April. And it was a lot of fun. Obviously, it was more fun because the Cubs won, but just that level of focus and intensity you need when there aren't really any holes in the lineup, especially, you know, when you start off Betts, Ohtani, Freeman, it's like, good God, how do you do this? And it just, you know, they just keep coming back in the lineup and seeing the pitchers rise to the occasion and handle them. It was a lot of fun. So mea culpa. It's fun to watch the Dodgers, even though I hate their whole vibe. It's good baseball.
By the time we come back, probably after the next homestand, hopefully we'll have even more fun talking about how they did in their first 20 plus games. But that's an even bigger sample size. Right now, it's whatever 9 divided by 162 is. Can't do math in my head anymore. But it's just barely, it's not even a tenth of the season. It's like a 16th. So it's not that much, but plenty to be encouraged about. I want to thank you gentlemen for hanging out with me tonight. You can, of course, find us at obstructiveview.net. This podcast is on Apple Podcasts, so please rate and review if you can. Theme song is by Rich Deanna, and Randall Sanders pulled the final out call from the 2016 World Series, which the Cubs won, because people forget that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I haven't forgotten that.
Oh, no, that was glorious.
Yeah, we're within the 10-year window, so let's see what happens in 24, guys. So, yeah, plenty of fun to be had. Let's do it.
Woohoo! Go Cubs!
It was more than just a game.